Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, the Strictly Regulation 2 guest today. Adam Faderman will talk about the criminalization of dissent, and Kay Gabriel will unpeel how the right is using the trans panic to wreck teachers' unions and public schools. Over the last decade or so, there's been a movement at all levels of government to criminalize dissent. These include expanded domestic terrorism laws and racketeering charges, which we've seen in the repression of protest against Cop City in Atlanta. We're almost certain to see more of it in the wake of the campus protests against Israel's war on Gaza. Here with more is Adam Faderman, a reporting fellow with Type Investigations and author of a cover story in These Times on the topic. Adam Faderman. Before the explosion of Gaza protests, I guess Cop City in Atlanta was maybe the most visible site of the criminalization of protest. How did that all evolve, and then what's been going on lately there?
Yeah, I mean, Cop City, the protest against the construction of this police training facility in Atlanta kind of began in late 2021. And last year we saw Georgia law enforcement really crack down on that movement and use both domestic terrorism laws and racketeering law to sweep up dozens of protesters who had been involved in that ongoing campaign and hitting them with really serious charges that, for example, the racketeering charge could be punishable up to 20 or 25 years in prison and pretty stiff fine. So it's really sort of sent a message to the campaign there. But lawyers and activists that I spoke to for this story also talked about how if these prosecutions are successful, and even in some cases, if they're not, other states may adopt similar tactics to go after social movements.
The use of domestic terrorism has been expanding across the states, right? What's been happening there?
State-level domestic terrorism laws emerged after 9/11, but haven't really been deployed until quite recently. Georgia is the most notable example, but Oregon recently passed a domestic terrorism law in 2023. And it also expands the definition of domestic terrorism to include actions that target so-called critical infrastructure, which in the case of Oregon actually includes roads and highways. So protests that in some way damages a highway or a road could in fact be considered an act of domestic terrorism. And in New York State, the legislature, a group of Democrats, in fact, have introduced a new bill in response to the protests against the war in Gaza that would make blocking a highway or bridge an act of domestic terrorism. So we're seeing this kind of model legislation replicate across different states with potentially severe consequences for those who engage in direct action.
And a reminder that while the Republicans are the worst on this, they're not the only ones.
No, not at all. You know, the New York case is one example, but even with some of the other critical infrastructure bills that emerged after the anti-pipeline campaigns of the 2010s, you know, the protests against the Keystone XL pipeline and then the mass action at Standing Rock against the Dakota Access Pipeline, we saw a slew of new laws that enhance penalties for trespassing on or near critical infrastructure.
The critical infrastructure thing is interesting. It emerged or was accelerated by the pipeline protests. But by defining the pipeline as critical infrastructure, you're criminalizing the very thing you're objecting to. Like the pipeline is the whole point of the thing. And then to complain about a pipeline becomes illegal. It's just remarkable that the control on speech and activity.
Absolutely. And I think it's also worth pointing out that engaging in civil disobedience or nonviolent direct action on or near a pipeline would already be a crime in most states, punishable as a, you know, usually a misdemeanor. So what these laws do in effect is they up the ante, they enhance penalties, in some cases making it a felony to engage in this kind of protest. And for example, Louisiana passed a bill in 2018 that was kind of emblematic of these new laws that created new penalties for pipeline protests, punishable by up to 5 years in prison and stiff fines. And it was a direct response to a campaign that was gaining steam around a project called the Bayou Bridge Pipeline. And what it did is it charged all these activists with felony trespassing and in effect took them off of the case and allowed them to put this pipeline in without resistance. So these laws have been used. They're not just, this is not an abstract thing, but it is having a real impact on the ground.
Felony trespassing is a striking phrase. I mean, one normally thinks of trespassing as a minor thing, but to make it a felony is pretty remarkable.
And then that's precisely the point, to inhibit these kinds of protests from happening. And I say in the story, in fact, that in many of these states, a Standing Rock style protest movement would be nearly impossible today.
Now, if we go back a couple of decades, most of these sorts of things were treated as misdemeanors. You'd get booked, released. Basically, nothing would happen to your life, right?
Yeah, you'd have, a misdemeanor perhaps on your record, or it would be scrubbed and maybe a night in jail. What we've seen in Atlanta with the Stop Cop City activists who've been charged with domestic terrorism and or racketeering, some have spent months in jail in pretrial detention waiting on bail. And, many of them now have domestic terrorism charges hanging over their head. I talk about a student at UNC Law School who was actually prohibited from attending class, even setting foot on campus after they returned, having been charged with domestic terrorism. So these things can really haunt people, and they make it harder to bring in new members and appeal to a wider audience, which is precisely the point. And I think, it is not necessarily the intention among law enforcement and prosecutors to convict on these charges. Many of them ultimately fall apart, but they do seek to undermine organizations and protest movements.
Sometimes you look at some of these laws and say, oh, this is not going to stand up under court challenge. Are they standing up under court challenge?
Yeah, it's a good question. Some have been challenged, I think a couple successfully, but really they have not been scaled back. They have not been successfully challenged. And I think in part because the language in the bills do not restrict speech. What they do is they heighten penalties for people who engage in these kinds of protest actions. So of course, activists can still block traffic or a sidewalk, but now they're going to be hit with a felony and potentially devastating fines. And it's not only the activists who are out on the street, but many of these laws also target organizations and institutions that in some way support or facilitate protest action. So that expands that widens the web dramatically in a way that can really hamper organizing.
Yeah, now they're trying to hold organizers liable, criminalizing fundraisers, bail funds, that sort of thing. It's really a very broad attack.
Yeah, we've seen that in Georgia too, with a new state level law that would severely restrict the ability of bail funds to operate in the state, basically allowing them only to bail out three individuals a year. And the folks I spoke to felt that it was a direct response to the Atlanta Solidarity Fund, which has been active in bailing out, activists who've been arrested in the Stop Cop City campaign. Although that particular organization has been around since 2016 and has been doing this kind of work. So that's quite troubling. And I think we will start to see similar laws in other states and also, potentially at the federal level too.
Going back a few years, the Black Lives Matter demonstrations and the demonstrations after the death of George Floyd, this was a spark also to more legislation, right?
Yes. Summer of mass action and unrest triggered by the killing of George Floyd. Not only a new crop of legislation, much of which targeted traffic-related protest, blocking traffic or blocking sidewalks, but also a shift, I think, in rhetoric. And this is sort of where the Trump administration's approach comes into play, the way that they demonized the Black Lives Matter movement and equated really any kind of mass action with extremism and in some cases terrorism, adopting a language that allows law enforcement to handle activists in a very sort of brutal and violent way. And I think some of that has carried over into what we're seeing with the protests against the war in Gaza on campuses across the country.
And Trump himself urged law enforcement to shoot them, right?
He said completely outlandish things. He had the protesters in Lafayette Square cleared so he could march through and pose for a picture in front of the church there. And yes, it basically said that law enforcement should be allowed to shoot protesters. And there have been reports that organizations trying to kind of fill out his administration are looking at invoking the Insurrection Act on day one if he is reelected, which would allow him to use the military on domestic protests in this country.
Now, at the federal level, Senator Tom Cotton, the guy who recommended running over protesters who are getting in your way if they're blocking the road, he has riot on his mind too, right?
Yeah, I mean, Tom Cotton, folks may remember the op-ed that he penned for the New York Times, basically suggesting that the military should be allowed to move in on Black Lives Matter protesters. Yeah, I mean, not surprisingly, he has introduced a bill in response to the protests around the war in Gaza, which he describes as pro-Hamas mobs, that would, you know, basically enhance penalties for so-called riot-related crimes, which is very vaguely defined. But it is similar to many of the state-level laws that have been adopted. So I think in a sense, we're seeing some of these state-level laws serving as a kind of template for federal legislation that is starting to be introduced, including another bill that Marsha Blackburn and Tom Tillis in North Carolina have introduced related to the protests around the war in Gaza. So I would imagine we will see more of this in the days and weeks and months to come.
And the language in these bills, state and prospective federal as well, is deliberately broad and vague, right?
It's deliberately broad and vague. And, you know, attorneys that I spoke to for this story often had a hard time explaining exactly what kinds of crimes they would target because it leaves a great deal of leeway to state prosecutors, state officials. And we've seen that in Georgia in the way that they've applied the domestic terrorism law and the RICO law to the Stop Cop City movement. So the language really gives them a lot of room to weaponize these laws in a way that can really include a broad cross-section of movements and activities. And it's worth pointing out that, I mean, we're talking about largely almost exclusively left progressive movements, but of course these laws could be applied to any action or protest. So it is quite a dangerous shift, I think, in this country.
Of course, we know who cops would prefer to go after, so, right?
Yeah, that's right, yes.
I'm speaking with Adam Federman, a reporting fellow with Type Investigations and author of a cover story in These Times and the Criminalization of Dissent. The current round of protests against Israel's war on Gaza has intensified the repressive urges to a degree that even I found shocking. The scenes of these cops just beating the crap out of students who are doing nothing. Any kind of legal developments coming out of this, or is it just like the cops doing some beatings on their own?
Legislation has been proposed. I believe there's a new bill coming out of Congress that would create anti-Semitism monitors on college campuses. We just talked about the Marsha Blackburn, Tom Tillis bill and the Tom Cotton bill. But I think what we're also seeing is the very quick resort to calling in law enforcement to break up these protests. I mean, what I found so striking was that the Columbia administration called in the NYPD the day after the encampment was set up. Doesn't really suggest that they had a lot of interest in negotiating with these students. And I do think that that set the tone for what we've seen since. And as you mentioned, you know, cops using pepper spray on protesters in Texas yesterday, and the truly shocking images of cops in riot gear tackling a professor at Emory in Atlanta who was simply defending the students' right to assemble and engage in speech.
Yeah, that's interesting that to watch these university presidents who you would think being some kind of skilled politician was part of the job, but they just call the cops. They're not trying to manage the situation in any constructive way. They just want to bust heads.
Yeah, and it clearly was a miscalculation. I mean, one of the great ironies, I think, in all of this was that you had the NYPD essentially defending the protesters and saying they were
they weren't doing anything wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, that doesn't make Columbia University look particularly good.
But yeah, watching these university presidents too, these are private actors. This is not state or federal action, and right. they're getting state assistance when they call the cops. But it does seem like the entire American elite, or at least a big portion of it, the political class, has just had it with protest of any kind, and they just want people to shut up and fall in line.
I think you're absolutely right. And part of the rhetoric surrounding protest has kind of furthered that narrative. But, you had a Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, go to Columbia to sort of exploit the protest for his own ends. And it's a very useful tool for these conservative lawmakers. You know, they can paint the protest actions as extremist and then, you know, use it to essentially silence or curtail speech and the freedom of assembly.
It's speech indeed. I mean, you mentioned an instance where three FBI agents showed up at the home of a woman in Oklahoma who had posted comments to her Facebook page critical of the war in Gaza. That's remarkable to get an FBI visit for that.
Right. And that was based exclusively on open source social media posts. And she made a big deal of that, which sort of brought it to light. But I think that this is something that's been greatly underreported because we just don't know yet the extent of FBI investigation of activists organizing around the war in Gaza. But I talked to people in Chicago who confirmed that the FBI and Chicago PD had visited the homes of at least one prominent leader in the Palestinian community there, and also two Yemeni families to question them. And this is especially sort of interesting in light of the fact that the Democratic Convention is coming up in Chicago. And obviously law enforcement and the FBI are on high alert. And we won't know for some time yet exactly how the FBI is dealing with both student groups and activists who are engaging on this issue.
And in Florida, the governor declared Students for Justice in Palestine a material support for terrorism. Which is a remarkable charge. They've walked it back some, but these are really serious threats.
Yeah, they tried to deactivate Students for Justice in Palestine. They were challenged. This is an example of, the ACLU challenged it, and the state eventually walked it back. But the deactivation order is still on the university system's website, and it's unclear whether they have intentions to pursue it or maybe in some other form. And of course, it's not limited to Florida. We've seen student groups suspended or, in fact, banned outright at other universities. And that material support provision, has been used for decades to target organizers and activists on this issue.
What might we expect of a second Trump administration should such a thing come to pass?
I think dark days indeed. I mean, I mentioned before that they've talked about invoking the Insurrection Act on day one. I mean, Trump absolutely despises protesters.
Now, it's virtually certain that there will be large demonstrations on his inauguration, right? I think that's pretty likely. So
if history serves as a, obviously the Women's March after he was elected in 2016, some of the largest protests in U.S. history. After the so-called Muslim ban, soon after he entered office, you had mass protests at airports across the country. So, yeah, I think there's no question people will continue to take to the streets. And how a second Trump administration would respond, I think it's really, truly terrifying. And we don't know, but we can imagine. And it would certainly give the kinds of tactics that we're seeing now, even on campuses, a great deal of fuel further that kind of crackdown.
Now, of course, the guy says a lot of things, but he's talked about suspending the Constitution, whatever that means in his imagination, but it's not going to be pretty.
Well, and I think we should take what he says at face value. And he's also said that he regrets not having invoked the Insurrection Act to put down the Black Lives Matter protests. So I have little doubt in my mind that he would resort to those kinds of tactics if given the opportunity. And I think you're absolutely correct that if he does win, we will see mass protest and the state will respond in kind.
As I was reading your piece, I was thinking that there are some left of center types who want to apply the terrorism label to white supremacists and the like. It strikes me as not a good idea to do that.
Yeah, I don't think you're alone on that. Law enforcement, including the FBI, has the tools that it needs to go after white supremacist groups, which is something that it, until recently hasn't really done. I mean, I've done a lot of reporting on the FBI's interest in the environmental movement, and they have little problem in characterizing those groups as extremists or domestic terrorists, which can really sort of inform the way that law enforcement responds to these kinds of movements. But, any kind of expansion of the definition of domestic terrorism, I think, always has the potential to bounce back in a deeply troubling way. And, you know, we've seen, we are seeing that in some ways at the state level, you know, both in Georgia and elsewhere as these laws are expanded.
So any thoughts on how to fight this stuff? You know, if you protest it, you might fall afoul of these laws. So any creative ways to fight this stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it is worth pointing out that although states have passed, I think it's 41 laws that are kind of characterized as anti-protest laws, that they've proposed many more. So something like 300 at least, and which, you know, most of those bills have been defeated. So if people are informed and they know that these bills are being proposed, which is not always the case, you know, putting pressure on lawmakers and explaining to them the kinds of repercussions it'll have on speech and assembly, you know, that is one way, I think, to defeat these bills and, you know, at the state level. And, you know, I do think that activists need to be informed. You need to know your rights, and you need to know how to protect yourself when you engage in nonviolent protest or just street marches, so that you're aware and informed about what the consequences might be.
It's striking how elites view any kind of protest as almost violent in itself, even if there's no violence involved. It's as if dissent itself in some people's minds is a violent act.
Right. And that, you know, that is something that has been sort of part of the fabric of the history of dissent in this country. But I do think there is a way in which protest is being painted as an extremist act in and of itself, with very real repercussions now. And, you know, I think we're seeing that play out in real time across the country on college campuses.
Yeah, it's like McCarthyism all over again, except with Hamas playing the role of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
It's dark stuff.
And, well, you do raise a good point, which also I think is that the Israel-Palestine issue does occupy a unique position in the political discourse in this country. So the response to this protest movement, I think, is sort of times 10 compared to, you know, what we've seen perhaps in other around other issues.
Although the Cop City thing, I mean, if you're protesting cops don't like that. I mean, it really goes to the heart of their violent power.
Yeah. Yeah. And I talk about this in the story. You know, the Georgia case study is one that activists and lawyers are watching very, very closely, because it really does set a new precedent. And I think it's worth pointing out that Georgia in those cases is using existing laws. They didn't create new laws to go after these activists, but they're using racketeering law, which was designed to go after organized crime, and the domestic terrorism law, which they in fact updated in 2017 after the massacre by Dylann Roof. They sort of used that incident to expand the domestic terrorism law, which is now being used to target the Stop Cop City movement.
Yeah, because we know how dearly the cops care about white supremacist violence. Did you look at all the public opinion on this? I'm afraid of the answer, but I suspect there might be some sympathy for cracking down on protest.
I didn't really look at any formal surveys, but I know that in many of the states that have passed the critical infrastructure bills, there does seem to be a fair amount of support for, you know, these tend to be states that are heavily reliant on the oil and gas industry. There tends to be a fair bit of support for these kinds of laws. But I do wonder in the context of what's happening now, if public opinion might start to shift. I think whenever you have cops beating peaceful protesters, the public sentiment does start to shift. And I think we may see that happen around the war in Gaza.
That was Adam Federman, a reporting fellow with Type Investigations. I hope he's right about public opinion showing some sympathy for protesters beaten by cops. I'm skeptical, but I'd welcome being proved wrong. The interview was recorded early this week before Columbia and other universities dialed 911. Adam added these comments in an email on Thursday morning. In recent days, hundreds of university students across the country have been arrested for engaging in nonviolent protest, and in some cases, riot police have used brutal tactics to subdue demonstrators and clear the encampments. Meanwhile, lawmakers are already proposing new bills that would limit speech and academic freedom, including the so-called Columbia Act, which would create federally sanctioned third-party anti-Semitism monitors on college campuses in what Republican Representative Mike Lawler, one of the bill's sponsors, has called a new model of enforcement. The crackdown and dissent continues. That's the end of the quote. One of the driving forces behind that Columbia Act is the appalling Representative Richie Torres of the Bronx. Torres's top donor in the most recent electoral cycle was the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, the infamous APAC, which gave him $141,000. Overall, his top two sectoral donors are finance and real estate, but number three was various pro-Israel interests. Hard to say whether this is an inducement or a reward or maybe both, but in any case, it's an index of his service to the cause. As I said during the interview, watching these university presidents make almost no effort to resolve these disputes politically through negotiation and compromise is a symptom of an authoritarian turn in the American ruling class, one entirely supported by the Biden administration. It's odd to hear Biden bloviating about Trump's threat to our democracy, which he is, don't get me wrong, when he's doing his best to snuff it out himself. Given the rapidity and similarity of responses to the Gaza protests across the country, it sure looks like these are coordinated at a national level, as they were during Occupy. This is Joe Biden's crackdown. It's not surprising that conservatives hate protests, with generous exceptions made for Charlottesville on January 6, but less appreciated, as though uncomfortable it makes liberals. Liberals hate the mob, which they fear as something of a viral reservoir of prejudice and irrationality. They like calm discourse and rule by experts, not occupations, even occupations as polite and orderly as the ones we've seen in recent weeks. Polite and orderly, that is, until cops or vigilantes step in. You're listening to Behind the News on Jacobin Radio. My name is Doug Henwood, back after a musical break. That was some of the Fantasy for Solo Flute No. 2 by Georg Philipp Telemann, performed by Patrick Galois. An anti-trans panic is afoot, mainly fueled by the right, but with an assist from queasy liberals and a subset of cultural feminists. It's vile and should be fought because it's ignorant and cruel. But it serves a hidden agenda for the right, as my next guest argues. Kay Gabriel, a New York-based writer and activist, has an article in N+1 magazine called Inventing the Crisis that argues that much of the point of the panic is to dismantle the public schools and bust teachers' unions. Kay is co-editor of We Want It All, an anthology of radical trans poetics published by Nightboat Books. Kay Gabriel. Before we get into the analysis, tell us first about the Moms for Liberty. Who are they? Where and when were they founded? How are they organized? How do they operate? Who funds them? That sort of thing.
As I discuss in the piece, Moms for Liberty is a right-wing front group. It was founded in January 2021, and almost overnight, it became this right-wing media darling. So about a month after they started, it got attention from the Rush Limbaugh show and from Tucker Carlson. And a report in the Tampa Bay Times by Maurice Cunningham documented that they receive funding from the same organizations that make up the Council for National Policy, which is a right-wing group that marries, let's say, social conservatism with various factions of capital and has attempted to dominate policy on the right since the Reagan years. Looking at Moms for Liberty and their donor base gives people who are studying the anti-trans panic some of the sense of, let's say, who the different constituents of that coalition are, what they are trying to bring together and what they're trying to do. But let's say before we dig into like the coalitional side of it, on the face of it, Moms for Liberty is an organization that is, let's say, it's like a social movement organization. It's a national organization with local chapters that is explicitly opposed to teachers' unions, which they call the K-12 cartel, and which has made a project out of going to school board meetings and decrying the inclusion of certain books in libraries and decrying policies that they say are trying to turn kids trans.
And now their feelings about trans people, which are pretty central to their view of the world, right?
Yeah, precisely. Well, so if we look at the anti-trans landscape that has solidified in the US over the course of the past, let's say, 18 months, you have people like Ben Shapiro and other people who are part of the Daily Wire, Matt Walsh especially, who are pushing really vigorously in the media sphere on YouTube, an anti-trans line, and who are saying things, I mean, Ben Shapiro says this all the time, who are talking about how teachers and Joe Biden and a number of other villains are trying to trans the kids. Moms for Liberty, you could call them the social movement warriors who take that idea and put it into practice in local contexts where they actually do have chances to move local power structures to agree with them. So they do seem to quite sincerely believe that it is a problem for children to be trans. They believe that their children are not trans, but that teachers who are, say, asking them pronouns or who have another trans student in the class and are defending that student's use of like name and pronouns or something, or who are refusing to out trans students to their parents before those students are ready, they believe that all of these things are introducing young people to sexual content, to sexually explicit content. The insidious implication here, right, is the idea that being trans, just being trans in front of young people is introducing them to, let's say, inappropriate, age-inappropriate sexual behavior or sexual display. And you can kind of like spin this idea out that being trans is a kind of like sexual perversion or sexual delusion. It's also the case that these people don't even really believe that being trans is possible. They don't agree that that's like a social category that actually exists or should. The things that they say about trans people is that it's a delusion. You know, they sort of, let's say, deny that people who transition or who, you know, do whatever we do to maintain a dignified life for ourselves, they deny that we actually live in the way that we do, maybe despite evidence to the contrary. But in addition to that, they also either imply or say outright that being trans is a form of sexual predation. And so this is the slander. The slander is that because being trans is a form of sexual predation, introducing young people to the possibility of being trans is a form of sexual predation of the youth.
One of the things that strikes me about these family values types, you know, the whole broad array of them over the last few decades, is their lack of confidence in the stability and appeal of their categories. Just a simple exposure to a trans person will make a kid trans. Well, maybe it's kind of attractive. Maybe, you know, their life is not so attractive. So if their worldview were so compelling, they wouldn't be so paranoid, it seems to me.
Right. Well, so one of the interesting things going on here, and I talk about this in the piece, is that, you know, Moms for Liberty set themselves up as the defenders of what they call parental rights. And they say that trans people and the Democrats or the left, and especially teachers unions, which are their main villain, are eroding parental rights. That is their rallying cry. And it's a swindle because actually they don't even believe in the ability of parents to set terms for their own families because they are quite supportive of things like the Ron DeSantis or the Greg Abbott administration's attempts to investigate the parents of trans children for child abuse. So they don't actually believe in this thing called parental rights. Even if they did, what's notable is that they are not actually defending the ability of families to thrive and to have the resources that they need to determine courses for their own lives. What would that look like? Among the things that would look like would be really robustly resourced free universal public education, which is precisely the institution that they have their guns trained on. So yes, I agree that they don't even really believe in the attractiveness of the ideals that they're setting forth. The bogeyman of the trans person who can just seduce, would be their word, children into just being trans, just by being like present in front of them. That gives us, frankly, a lot of power. And they are not, in fact, defending the institutions or the people who they claim to defend. But, you know, I mean, in addition to that, you know, we can also say, like, look, Doug, as you're pointing out, young people, like people of all ages, deserve the right to set courses for their own lives, including over like sex, gender, and sexuality. And this is something that clearly young people in all kinds of places are drawn to over and over again, even when met with really horrific coercive measures. And the idea that you can just police or coerce people out of doing what they're going to do and doing what they're drawn to do is disproven in fact. People under all kinds of circumstances display enormous tenacity to push past conversion therapy and forced detransition and whatever it is. And also, it is the case, it is absolutely true that like fighting for the right for people to transition when they want to, with public resources and support to do so, that is a really important political goal.
Okay, let's talk about parental rights. What do they mean by those two words?
Yeah, I mean, it's a swindle. It's the same logic as right to work. It's the same idea that by using individual choice as the means to destabilize a public institution that actually defends and enhances collective power and collective resources. So in the same way that right to work is a euphemism for the ability of individuals who disagree with or depart from the unions that are winning life-changing contracts for them. It defends the ability to not pay dues or to not participate in the union, to not be a member. Parental rights is a neat ideological trick that props up things like school vouchers and other means of shrinking public expenditures on public education and treats this form of dispossession as a way of bolstering individual power. To do what? Individual power to pull your child out of public school and have a school voucher like you can do in Florida now and take your kid either into, let's say, homeschooling or into a private, ideologically and explicitly Christian form of education or something like that. And in this sense, you can sort of see what I was saying earlier about Moms for Liberty being a front group that unites different interests, because it's a very clever way to put together people whose object is like a particularly ideologically enforced right-wing, let's say Christian nationalism, and people whose aim is to defund public education, strip teachers' unions of their ability to affect a power structure in a given place, shrink the state by any means necessary. That's the ideological work that parental rights does.
It's interesting to point out, and important, I think, to point out that the roots of this war in the public schools and the promotion of vouchers and all that goes back to the backlash against Brown v. Board of Education in the mid-50s.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can think about how, in this case as well, the anti-trans lawfare has been obviously put together with this lawfare that's very explicitly designed to punish and police individual teachers, and also goes together with laws that are explicitly opposed to anti-racist forms of education. The Stop Woke stuff that the DeSantis administration is also pulling, or the rewriting of textbooks to remove information about civil rights victories, and other attempts to, let's say, reimpose racial segregation in fact, if not in name.
I'm speaking with the writer and activist Kay Gabriel, who has a piece on the Trans Panic in N+1 magazine. How does this relate to their other obsessions, like particularly critical race theory? They do share a common strategist, Christopher Rufo, who it must be said is pretty good at his evil work. But what's the connection here?
So Rufo deserves a particular note here because, Doug, as you say, in 2021, Rufo made the extremely strategic decision to turn an obscure academic term for a particular series of ideas that were really applied in like practicing law into a household name. Why did he do that? Well, he said in an interview, I think even with the New Yorker, which is kind of funny, that every word in critical race theory pulls badly. Critical sounds bad to most people. Race sounds like you're being accused of being racist. Theory sounds elite and like something you can't understand. So he made this decision to turn CRT into a moral panic. A year later, he basically made the same decision to do something similar, about to take the grooming panic, which started actually as a QAnon phenomenon, and to turn it into and to put it into the anti-trans movement. You know, a lot of people, myself included, were stupefied by the forward avalanche of anti-trans legislation last year, the pace of it, how successful it was in how many places, how sadistic it became. But we need to remember that the architects of the panic have names and faces and addresses, and there aren't that many of them. They were, in fact, equipped with a sort of, as I said, like a kind of a social movement that was prepared to put their ideas into practice. But there were a handful of very smart people who decided that this should be the strategy. What do the anti-trans panic and anti-CRT, and now it's like anti-DEI. What do all of these have in common? Well, you can think about it as they are various ways of renovating the same playbook, which is to say, to gin up moral outrage around something that parents who do feel pretty disempowered in their day-to-day lives can believe that teachers and the state and people who they don't have control over are doing to their children when they're not around. And so it follows, let's say, a very similar playbook time after time, and once again, very cleverly puts together a form of social conservatism with a strategy to diminish state expenditures, shrink public expenditures by any means necessary, destabilize unions that have been militant and the bulwark of working class power. I mean, it's very smart. The thing that we should note here is that all of these things disrupt potential coalitions between labor unions that can be very powerful at changing social conditions and people who are attempting to push forward a liberatory agenda, an anti-racist agenda, an agenda of queer and trans liberation. The attempt here on the part of the right is to disrupt that coalition and to isolate the people who intend to push it forward.
Okay, let's talk a bit about their strategies, the fronts of their war. They pick as their leading edge two things that might sound reasonable to people who are not particularly transphobic. One, sports, unfair competition. And two, kids. They're just too young to think for themselves. Is that a fair characterization of what they're up to?
Yeah, it's absolutely a fair characterization. Well, let's start with sports. The idea that the threat to school athletics or schooling in general is the wrong people winning low-stakes social competitions is, of course, it's laughable, but it is also a very, again, let's say, savvy attempt to redirect outrage on a handful of targets rather than the people who have defunded public education so badly that athletics programs in many public schools are shuttered or gym facilities are crumbling. So the idea that the threat to school athletics is a handful of let's say, unjustly talented people who are unjustly winning competitions, I mean, that provides a very convenient target for outrage rather than the conservative administrations, Republican or Democrat, that have, for the better part of half a century, embraced austerity agendas and diminished the quality of life for all young people.
The kids are too young to think for themselves.
Precisely. So again, in a way, it's an old right-wing playbook to go after specifically queer and trans people. As Max Fox discusses really well in his essay for Parapraxis, The Traffic in Children, which is a different way of talking about the anti-trans panic. And I disagree with him a little bit. But, you know, one of the things that Max talks about there, and he's really, you know, on the money, is that there are all of these like closely held ideologically protected ideas about the sanctity of children that make it so that people, even people who have all kinds of other ideas about how life should be, feel that they have to stand up and defend these ideas and protect the child. When, of course, in fact, you know, you look at all the medical evidence, you look at all the sociological evidence, and it's very clear that young people have all kinds of ideas about gender and sex and sexuality and all kinds of ideas about how they can be in the world. These are not adult ideas. These are ideas that manifest among young people in all kinds of ways, that people should have the resources and the ability and the latitude to feel their own way through, because that is how all people figure out what a meaningful and dignified life for them should look and feel like. And we have all of the evidence that we need to demonstrate that that's true. But the logic of the moral panic is really effective at whipping people into a frenzy to believe that kids are being sexualized too fast, that kids are being drawn or pulled out of the sphere of control of the family, that people are being introduced to ideas that they are not ready for. And of course, the other thing here that we should keep in mind is that it is actually true that public education is an important place where young people can develop oppositional consciousness. That's one of the reasons why, you know, I mean, this is an example that Ruth Wilson Gilmore loves to talk about. An advisor to Ronald Reagan, when he was governor of California, called public education dynamite.
Oh, no, he said we didn't want free college tuition because that would create an educated proletariat, which would be political dynamite.
Right. Okay, precisely. But you can think about, you know, if that's the educating the working class at a post-secondary level that they're recognizing as political dynamite, right? You can think of Moms for Liberty and the people who fund them as recognizing the same thing in K-12 education, or what they call the K-12 cartel.
The moms represent a coalition between market fundamentalists and Christian nationalists. What's the glue that holds those things together?
Yeah, I mean, basically, you know, this is a coalition in which one side contributes the market analysis and policy depth and has a particular vision of how to take apart public institutions and state expenditures and how to disrupt public sector unions. And the other side, the Christian nationalist side, provides, let's say, the social movement foot soldiers, the people who in substantial numbers are actually moved to put this into practice. It's not necessarily the case that the two sides of this coalition need to work together, but they are very useful to each other.
And it seems like one of their nightmares is a coalition between teachers and the public to improve the quality of public education. They don't want that to happen, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, well, you can think about all of the important examples, and I bring them up in the essay, where this coalition has, in fact, successfully won really astounding victories. The Chicago Teachers Union strikes, or you can think about UTLA, or you can think about the West Virginia teacher strike, or the school staff, the support staff, actually not teachers, in Ontario, 55,000 of whom walked off the job in November 2022 in a 98% out strike. And they were backed by two-thirds of the province. And Doug Ford, the extremely conservative premier of Ontario, threatened to pull a constitutional maneuver to basically destroy the right to strike. And then all these other unions, some of whom had backed his government, threatened a general strike to make him back off. It was this kind of amazing demonstration. All of these situations show how the combination of teachers' unions with the backing of the parents and families who they teach can win amazing contracts that change the lives of teachers, can bargain for victories for their students and for parents, can knock conservative governments back on their heels. This is a powerful coalition. And, you know, frankly, like if teachers unions were in fact prepared to fight for anti-racist victories and were prepared to fight for the rights of trans people, that would in fact be a really powerful social force that would help both of these constituencies, or all of these constituencies, make real durable gains. And this is something that, you know, like a bunch of people who are our opponents are watching and are scared of, and they are right to be scared of, because this is a real source of power.
How do we fight this? Let's say you become our side's Christopher Rufo. How would you approach this?
That's giving me a lot of credit, but sure. I do suggest in the essay, and I'll say it again here, that the right is attempting to neutralize the power of a coalition that doesn't even really yet exist between, say, fighters for trans liberation and militant, democratic, worker-led unions of the kind that have won stunning victories in the past several years. if that coalition really came into being, that would be a substantial force to be reckoned with. And there are, of course, there are all kinds of places, including and especially the places that have passed the most vigorous anti-trans legislation, where unions are relatively or extremely weak. And that, let's say, includes the South. Although the victory that the workers at the Volkswagen plant demonstrated just a couple weeks ago by, you know, winning like a 73% election and in a large plant that is like a multiracial, anti-racist force for workers in an extremely conservative anti-union place, that shows the kind of work that we need to do in places that have been, you know, the most vigorous in banning abortions, the most vigorous in reinstating forms of racial segregation, and the most vigorous in terms of pursuing anti-trans lawfare. In other places, we can think about how to, in other places where unions are relatively strong, turning for teachers and nurses and other workers who do engage with young people who may or may not become trans, for them to understand and to recognize that part of their mission in this mission-driven work is to secure and strengthen the ability of people to transition and to live their lives with dignity, and for them to understand that that will also strengthen their position as workers and as a union because it will bolster them against these kind of anti-worker attacks, that would be a coalition that would be a real force. So I think that that is the way forward. And I think that for people who are interested, who have a stake in beating back the real threat of fascism and the very canny attempts by the right to divide these constituencies against each other, turning that coalition into a reality is our task.
That was Kay Gabriel, author of an article in N+1 magazine on the right's use of the anti-trans panic. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, some of Violent Times from St. Vincent's new album, All Born Screaming. Till next week, bye.